The October 7th declaration of war in Israel has not only displayed evil on a level not witnessed in today's modern era, but this also ignited barbaric hostilities across the globe. At its core, the foundation is the land ownership of Israel, or as others will claim, the land of Palestine. This problem has plagued mankind for thousands of years, and according to the Bible, peace will not be obtained until the second coming of Jesus Christ. What if you are not a believer in Christianity, Islam, or Judaism? How about removing the religious components and examining the legal rights and historical truths? Sadly, it appears many are not aware, but blindly repeat and stand for what feels right. Considering the world appears on the precipice of expanding these wars, intellectual and spiritual apathy or ignorance should be avoided at all costs. Please consider joining us for a close and rigorous examination without prejudice in Israel, Palestine, and Hamas. Which is it? The historical, legal, and biblical facts. Hello, everybody. My name is Mark. You're watching the Russick Outlook, or perhaps you're listening on podcast. Either way, thanks very much for joining. Today's discussion is timely and appropriate. The title is Israel, Palestine, and Hamas. Which is it? The legal, historical, and biblical facts. It shouldn't take anyone by surprise the necessity for this topic. As you look around the world, violence is breaking out, protests are breaking out, and the points of view and the things that are being perpetrated out there are 180 degrees apart at times. And for that reason, that means somebody must be wrong. There must be some degree of either misinterpretation or lie or ignorance or whatever you want to call it. But regardless, truth is truth. There is no gray area. So that's what I want to get into. I'm certainly, as a Christian, I'm interested in what the biblical origins of this is and what the biblical truths are. But also, if you're not a believer, if you're a skeptic, or perhaps you're a person of the Muslim faith, the Judaism, or maybe you're atheist or agnostic and you don't understand what's going on, or perhaps you do and you're still interested in, well, maybe there are some additional facts. And I promise you there are. There's some information that I'm going to present that I'm pretty confident over 90% of the audience, if not more, is not aware of. So that's really what this is about. Before I begin, I'd ask if you wouldn't mind, whatever the platform you're on, to please hit the like and the subscribe button. It really helps us get the information out. Ring the bell and comment, you know, or share. Please share the information with friends, with family members, because everybody is touched by this topic right now in one way or another. So it's really important to get accurate information out there. And also, if you wouldn't mind, please go to the Russick Outlook and sign up for our email list. We notify you of new videos and other things. So let me get into this. As I said, there you have it, and the reasons for it. So before I begin, I want to kind of lay out what the occupation of this land has looked like historically. So on the left-hand side, if you're following me on video, I put check marks by them so it would hopefully stick out a little bit more. And it begins with ancient Israel, and we'll be getting into that. And by ancient Israel, I am certainly referring to the time that we can record historically, the building of King Solomon's temple. And from there, we know about the captivity or the capture of the Hebrews from the Babylonian Empire. From there, you went to the Persian Empire and then the Greek Empire. So those are three large world empires that began in that area. That then escalated to what is called the Hasmonean Dynasty, which, you know, most people are not going to be familiar with that. And it's just for the local area of the Dynasty of Judea. I show you that in the arrow there. And the surrounding regions. And this is really during the Greek Empire. From there, we go to the Roman Empire. I think everybody's pretty familiar with that. and then and we'll be getting into that. And you certainly have the fall of the temple, and then we will talk about around 1:30, where the name was changed from Israel to Palestine, and we're going to get into the reasons behind that. Then you had the Byzantine era, the Arab Caliphate, which at this time you had the birth of Islam, which is 622 after the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Then you had the Crusaders, the Mamluk area, the Ottoman Empire, which is the Turks, which they had it for 500 and some odd years, to the British Mandate, to what you now have is the State of Israel from circa 1948. What I'd like to just briefly mention and take note of, the Ottoman Empire, you see that begin in 1517, and then that was handed over to the Brits due to the loss in World War I in 1917. So from 1517 to roughly 1947, it was the Turks and the Brits that had that land. Excuse me. The Jewish people were living in Israel for 2,100 years before anyone was called Palestinian, and 2,600 years before Islam became a religion. And, you know, that's just the facts. Then in terms of the earliest known entities that we have, or facts or books or state, it's called a stele, and it's art and it's inscription of language. And we have the oldest one. It is called the Merenpath Stele, which bears the first mention of any entity called Israel in Canaan. It is robustly dated at 1210 BC, roughly little 3,233 years ago. So that's the earliest known. And we have that inscription calling it Israel. Then you also have one from the 9th century, where it also makes mention of the record of the House of David or King David. So those are historical archaeological discoveries. And, you know, again, this is Bible aside. So I said I wanted to touch on something right away that kind of struck me, and I wasn't aware. So from 586 BC, when the Babylonians first took captivity, and I will say, side note, that was prophetically written in the Bible well before it happened. And then I would say from 586 to 1948, so that's 2,500 years, the Jews were dispersed, they were killed, they were captured, they were oppressed all around the world. If you're alive today, you should be very much aware of what happened in World War II and the Holocaust. In 135 AD, the Jews tried to revolt against the Roman Empire at the time. You had the Roman Emperor Hadrian. He squashed the revolt, and he named the land. He dispersed the Jews. That's where they were, not first, but that it was running up to from the time of 70 AD when the temple fell throughout, and then the Jews were officially banished from the land. Around the world, as was prophesied in the Bible. And he named it Palestina because the Palestinians or the Philistines, that's where the name is taken from, and they were the sworn enemies of Israel. So as a matter of sticking it to them, if you will, he named that land. So it was not a culture, it was what he named because of the enemies of Israel at the time. And that name kept through right up and through 1947. What I want to show you on video is if you were born in this area of the world, you know, that was being called Palestine, your birth certificate, regardless of your religious backing, said you were Palestine or Palestinian. I'm showing you two Jewish birth certificates, one from 1926, from a gentleman named Avraham Itzhak Richman, and then from 1936, the Jewish girl, and it's laid out in English, Hebrew, and Arabic as she has been born in Palestine. So right away, that's saying, you know, that's an area of the world what's being called, and they're not identifying you if you are a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian or whatever. It doesn't matter. you were labeled as Palestine. So as I kind of want to get right up into as close to the modern era, but give you some historical background from the Balfour Declaration. So as I said, the Turks had the land up and through 1917 when World War I and they were defeated. The British took over that land. I will say, and we'll get into this a little bit, the Jews started coming into the land in the late 19th century. And I've covered this, and this is historically, you know, factual. They started to buy the land, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But the what was called the Balfour Declaration, they recognized that the Jewish people were in need and had the right to a homeland, and that homeland being at the time what was called Palestine. So I'm showing you on the map here for those on video. On the left-hand side, you see what the land that was that the Brits took, and they were going to get ready to hand that land over to the Jewish people, the what would eventually become Israel. In 1922, King Hussein objected to this and approached Winston Churchill, who was the Secretary of State at the time, and this is all rumor. He drew a line where the Jordan River was, and he said everything to the east of that would be become Jordan or Transjordan at the time, and then to the west of that would become Jewish or under the Jewish domain. And then that was eventually, and you see this on the right-hand side, where the green is what is being partitioned for the Jewish people, and then that brown color is the Palestinians. So you see there what's called the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and then to the left the by the Mediterranean Sea, the Gaza Strip. It's a little bit expanded beyond what it is today. So right away, they didn't get nearly as much as what they thought. And again, I'm showing you this on map. So what's interesting is if you go to after 1917 and 1920, all of the, after a couple of years now after World War I, the Allied leaders of World War I gathered in San Remo, Italy, to divide the remains of the Ottoman Empire. In this resolution, they included what was originally laid out in 1917 during the Balfour Declaration. The resolution was signed by the League of Nations, which eventually turned into the UN, and that the British were put in charge of Palestine, meaning the British were legally bound to help build the Jewish state there because they had designated that part for the Jews. This was signed by 51 members of the League of Nations, guaranteeing a Jewish state by international law. If you go to 1922, from when this is from the San Remo resolution, the recognition has thereby been given to the historical connection of the Jewish people with Palestine and to the grounds for reconstituting their national home in that country. So there you have what came out of there. And even after that, they lost more land. It was kind of chipped away at, if you will. But nonetheless, the Jewish people took ownership, and they declared themselves a country in 1948. Many people are aware, the United States jumped in 11 minutes later at the United Nations and backed that accord, and eventually they were admitted into the United Nations in 1949. They are a sovereign state admitted to the United Nations in 1949. So again, on video, I'm just going to show a couple of things. I show you Harry Truman with David Ben-Gurion. David Ben-Gurion's Truman's letter to the left recognizing it, Ben-Gurion's statement. And then I find this interesting, Isaiah 66:8, and he said says this, "Who has heard of such things? Who has ever seen things like this? Can a country be born in a day or a nation be brought forth in a moment? Yet no sooner is Zion in labor that she gives birth to her children." So that's exactly what happened in one day in 1948, May 14th. in that day that the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. Isaiah 11:10. What do we have today is that that symbol of the root of Jesse, which is the Star of David, and that is, sure enough, it's another prophecy that came to pass. So if, again, I'm assuming some things here that people are aware of. 1948, it began. The next day, the surrounding areas attacked the Israelis. And really, there was no formal government at the time. It took them another year to get that. They didn't have much. There was no army. So it was, you know, for lack of a better word, knives, guns, whatever they had, plates, knives, kitchen utensils, anything. But nonetheless, they were able to secure their land despite the surrounding armies coming in. Then in 1967, you have what is known infamously as the Six-Day War, where your surrounding countries of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon simultaneously attacked the Israelis, and their mission was to push them to the sea, to eliminate them, to disperse of the Jews. And miraculously, in that 6 days, and I'm going to show you now, again, going back to video and the maps, in those 6 days, you see what it was on the left-hand side. I'm showing you the map. And then the land that they gathered in the green is what eventually went to Israel. So the West Bank, the Golan Heights, Gaza, and the Sinai Peninsula down below, all of that land in 6 days, despite all these surrounding countries attempting to do it, the Israelis not only fended them off, they captured this land back from what was originally theirs. Today, the Sinai Peninsula was given back to the Egyptians as part of the peace accords that were struck with Anwar Sadat in 1978, I believe. So the Egyptians have that today. Then you have the discussions of the West Bank and Gaza and Golan Heights. That's really the topic of conversations and what most of this stems at. Certainly the emphasis with the war right now is Gaza, and we're going to get into this. But I think there's something very important to take note of. If you see on the left-hand side, the West Bank, all of that area was Jordan. What was originally called Transjordan and then was later named as Jordan. So that is Jordanian. That was never Palestinian. It was, that area was called Palestine prior. But if you go from the Brits, from the Ottoman Empire to the Brits to handing it over, it was Jordanian. So that whole time from 1948, 47, up until 67, there was nothing there in terms of any type of Palestinian naming, I'll call it, but certainly governed by the Arabs. And, you know, a side note, most people question him, but the general at the time, Moshe Dayan, they captured Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, and the Temple Mount. And they made a gesture of peace to give the Temple Mount under the auspices of the Jordanians, and they still have the ownership of that area today. But that was a gesture of peace to give that to them because of how the Muslims regard this, hold this in such high regard with the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I'm not going to go into the history of that, but nonetheless, and that is still under Jordanian control. What I want to touch on here is the legal aspect of this, and this was brought before international court because of how the Israelis captured this land back, because remember, the surrounding nations wanted to eliminate them. So the court came back from, it was Judge Stephen Schwebel, I'm sorry, from What Way to Conquest. But this is what his ruling was. A state, meaning Israel, acting in lawful exercise of its right of self-defense, may seize and occupy foreign territory as long as such seizure and occupation are necessary to its self-defense. clearly that was necessary with all these nations around it trying to eliminate them. Where the prior holder of territory, which would be Jordan, had seized that territory unlawfully, the state which subsequently takes that territory in the lawful exercise of self-defense has, against that prior holder, the better title. So the legal ruling was, and again, this is not about Gaza per se, this was really addressing the West Bank, but Gaza was part of it as well as the Golan Heights. If you look at this area today, many people are saying they should go back to pre-1967 lines when legally this territory is theirs, and I'll show you why biblically it is, but I'm just saying legally in terms of the International Court of United Nations, League of Nations, this has all been well-documented and historically sound, and you will find, I will get to, backed by many, many Arab nations. So, now to the Gaza Strip. The Gaza, you see, that's near the, it's on the coast, it's by the Egyptian border, and I'm showing you that on the left-hand side. It is roughly 32 miles long on land, about 24 miles by on the sea. That border by Egypt is roughly 8 miles wide, and to the north it's about 6 miles wide. You are on the border of Egypt today, and this is the area of contention. This is where people are saying that the Israelis are occupiers. They are not occupiers. They gave this land, and I'm describing this, and I don't know that I cut to it. I apologize. So I'm just on the maps. I'm showing you Gaza, and that whole area, what I just described. But what I want to get at is, I can't remember the Israelis, Ariel Sharon, I'm sorry, and Yasser Arafat, and the American administration, which would have been Bush at the time. Prior to this, there were Jewish settlers in this land. They farmed this land. They worked this land. It was a prosperous area. It was a beautiful, highly regarded area because naturally, the beaches of the Mediterranean. But as a matter of land for peace, they gave this land. And some might say, well, it was Palestinians to begin with. Okay. But they moved them out. There was roughly 400 settlers that were forced, Jewish settlers were forced. The Israeli government went in, destroyed the home, took the homes down, much to the dismay of many Israelis. They did this as a gesture of trying to get to a land for peace deal. Now, people will say, well, it's their oppressors because of the wall surrounding that area. And there is a wall surrounding that area, and it's a wall of defense. And, you can see why a couple of weeks later that was necessary. And then, for that matter, it clearly had its areas of problem areas. But what I'm getting at is this whole area was given to the people of Gaza, and they ran it. They were provided money by the Israelis, and I'm gonna say up until at least a year ago. I know they're not giving any money now, but they are in receipt of funds from all around the world, from humanitarian funds, from the UN. Aid from, I know, from the United States. Current administration just gave them even more or authorized more money. But the problem is, and we're going to get into this, into the history of Hamas, they, in 2007, I believe, or 6, they were legally bought in to run the government for that area. So that's really the bone of contention for where we're at right now, because it is Hamas, under the auspices of that umbrella organization, that is financed and funded and fueled by the Iranians. They are the ones that drive the the direction of this area. So I will also say, prior to this, if you lived in Gaza and you provided the, or you had work in other areas beyond Gaza in Israel, you were allowed to go past checkpoints if you have your papers, much like you do when you're traveling from one country to another. If you're in Europe, you know you can travel in and out, but you do have to go through checkpoints and you do have to provide the proper papers. And I'm not saying that's ideal by any means, and I don't mean to insinuate that. But what I am saying is you can go from Gaza into Israel and back and forth, and many, many people did. They worked in Israel. You have millions of Arabs in Israel today. You have Arabs in the government of Israel, in Jerusalem. You have Arabs in the cabinet. You have judges in the court system. It's not that, but you know that is what's going on. So you have that wall around Gaza, but you were able to go in and out. Okay, so let's get into who is Hamas. Let's cut back to video for a second. So Hamas, the acronym in Arabic, translates to the Islamic Resistance Movement. In Arabic, it means zeal or strength. In Hebrew, it's called Hamas with a C, C-H, and it means violent. The Hamas Charter, again, you can get this online, and they don't hide this. It says this: Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before it. The day of judgment will not come until Muslims fight Jews and kill them, Article 7. Article 32, that first line I gave you was the preamble. Article 32. Hamas regards itself the spearhead and the vanguard of the circle of struggle against world Zionism. Islamic groups all over the Arab world should also do the same, since they are best equipped for their future role in the fight against the warmongering Jews. So, you know, I don't need to elaborate on that. So here's a timeline of events with Hamas. It was founded in Gaza by Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, a Palestinian cleric and offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's important. Let me actually go into that for a second. Muslim Brotherhood had its origins in Egypt. If you go back to the Arab Spring, roughly, I think that was 2011, if I'm not mistaken, around that time, and you know, many people should be familiar with that. That's when you had President Mubarak of Egypt was ousted by, I can't remember his name, but it was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were trying to get back to the position of an Islamic caliphate. Eventually, they weren't in there long before the army took over, and General Sisi, who is the president today, took them down, jailed a lot of, and I believe that leader is still in prison in Egypt, in Cairo. Many of them are. Ironically, the 44 in this country was a strong supporter of this Arab Spring and the ruling or the implementation of the Muslim Brotherhood. That should tell you something. But nonetheless, the reason I'm bringing this up is because as I showed you on the map, the border of Gaza and Egypt, they don't want, even for humanitarian purposes right now, they do not want these people coming in there because they are concerned about more stemming and rising with its origins similar to the Muslim Brotherhood. So the Egyptians don't want it, and I will say the Jordanians don't want it because they're familiar with what that background is. So And I'm going to show you on a map all the options that they did or would have had, but they don't. And I would say because of their vitriol, their thirst for violence, their thirst for bloodshed, for dominance, for the eventually, I mean, this is really, to me, it's clear, and I'm not trying to put my spin on it, but I am interpreting what I see, read, and hear from their actions. They want an Islamic caliphate to dominate the world. 1988, Hamas published its charter for the destruction of Israel and the establishment of the Islamic State in its place. We read some of that. The new military wing, the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades, was established in 93. It's when they began suicide bombings in Israel prior to the Oslo Accords, which gave the Palestinian Authority autonomy and limited authority in Gaza and the West Bank. So for those of you who remember Yasser Arafat, he was kind of running things in both areas, which, you know, the West Bank and Gaza. In 97, they were designated as a terrorist organization by the U.S. and dozens of other countries in response to the group's Iran-supported use of explosives and rockets, along with suicide bombings and kidnappings of Israelis. 2000, the deadly Intifada uprising of Palestinians against Israelis. In 2005, which is what I alluded to earlier, Israel evacuated all their troops and settlers from Gaza, built a security fence around Gaza for their security. And clearly it was warranted. 2006, they won a surprise victory in the Palestinian parliamentary elections and seized full control of Gaza, overthrowing the forces loyal to President Mahmoud Abbas, which is now what's called the Fatah organization in the West Bank. So I say that because the Hamas does not necessarily see eye to eye with the group run by Mahmoud Abbas. He was supposed to have, I think, a four-year term. He's now in there for 18 years. He replaced Yasser Arafat. So, but you still have a loyal cause to both. So you still have members of Hamas living in the West Bank area, or as we know, Judea and Samaria. So as a result, much of the international community cut off aid to Gaza because they did not want to finance sponsored terrorism. And I will say 45 in this country cut that aid off for that reason. 46 later reinstated it. October 7th, we know about the war, so I'm not going to get into that. So there you have your Hamas timeline, you have your Hamas charter. I'm going to start to work my way towards the biblical and religious component according to the Bible. And I will say this right now. What I see around the world, this outgrowth of anti-Semitism, it is a spiritual war. This is Satanism. Anti-Semitism is Satanism. I'm crystal clear in my mind about that. When you want to eliminate people from the face of the earth because of their Jewish heritage, I cannot think of anything more evil, and who is the author of that? That is Satan. So that's my opinion. But let me cut back to this. So why? Why are they so intent on destroying him? There is an animosity over the promise, and we'll get a little bit into this now, is you have the descendants of the Arabs as Ishmael, and of the Jews it is Isaac, and we'll cover that. And I will say that the Jews and the Arabs agree to this. This is why you had your covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, because the Muslims recognize Abraham. They know that they are, you know, descendants from Ishmael, which was Abraham's son, and so there's no dispute about it. So interestingly, Abraham is highly regarded in the Islamic circles, the Judaism circles of Judaism and Christianity. But I would say the rise of anti-Semitism and what we're seeing around the world today is incited by Satan. Revelation 12, I believe you see this if you read about the dragon. And the woman, which is Israel, and how he waits to devour the child, which is the representation of Jesus. But this all goes back to that fight for good and evil. Before Abraham was given his name was Abram, and he lived in Iraq, and he was a Gentile. So this was before the birth of the Jews, and God called him to a nation. He gave him the areas, and he is the father of Israel. So through this race of people is really what the Lord was laying out, is eventually where the Messiah would come from, eventually from the house of David. And in this, you see that Genesis 12:3, God declares blessings and curses. Bless Israel, and I will bless you. Curse Israel, and I will curse you. And that's been pretty obvious over the years. And I would say my opinion is a good result of American prosperity and what we've done in the world is a result of our honoring our Christian heritage and our allegiance and our friendship to Israel. Gaza, it is mentioned 19 times in the Bible. Gazites is mentioned once. It's also mentioned in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10. We'll quarrel that. Four prophets warned Gaza of impending doom. So I always say if something's mentioned more than once in the Bible, twice, three times, four times, Gaza is mentioned 19 times. And again, you know, call it what you will, those are important reasons. So as a Christian now, I just very quickly give you a reason why I'm concerned and I look to Israel is because God gave the world a Savior that was born in Israel. He died in Israel. He was resurrected in Israel, and he is coming back to Israel. And I show you something here on a little bit of the charts. Number one, all of the prophets, you know, they laid this out that the Messiah was coming, and they, just as what was prophesied, he would be born in Bethlehem. Sure enough, he was. He would enter into Jerusalem as the king on the mule or a colt. And sure enough, he did. Number four, that you know, that was prophesied he would be crucified on a tree or wood, and he was. That he would be resurrected. And then you have, that's number five. Number six, 50 days later, Pentecost, where Holy Spirit came. And I put the little church there because that is the birth of the church age as we know it. And seven is what we are looking for, the return of Jesus. And as Jesus laid out in the scriptures, he is coming back to Israel. He's coming back specifically to Jerusalem when he returns. So, you know, the Bible records the historical data of Israel, and it prophetically details events that are about to happen. The Bible is a book about Israel. And, you know, some people may have a problem with that, but it's the truth. The history of Israel is laid out, and you know, Jesus came for the entire world, for the Arabs, for the Jews, for the Gentiles, for all of us. But nonetheless, that's why, from a biblical aspect, it's so important. Breaking down a little bit about Ishmael, what I said in Genesis, and I'll show you on the screen here. This is a great nation. The Arabs are a great people. Verse 11, the matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son. This is when Hagar is the concubine was going to leave. And God said to him, do not be so distressed about the boy and your slave woman. Listen to what Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the slave into a nation also because he is your offspring. So this is, again, the offspring of Abraham. Jumping down to verse 17, God heard the boy crying. The angel of God called to Hagar, who is his mother, from heaven and said to her, what is the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. So, you know, there you have it. He's calling it a great nation. Sorry about that. Oh, a little bit of technical difficulty here. There we go. So from that, I just kind of want to break down where we see the lineage and the distinction or the delineation of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. So I'm going to show you on video from Abraham, Hagar to Ishmael. This is how you get Islam. And then from Sarah to Isaac to David, you get Judaism. From the house and the lineage of David is Jesus, which leads to Christianity. So on that note, that's kind of the backing of it, if you will. Now I'd like to show you a little bit more detail, both historically and biblically, about this area of land in Gaza, because it's important. Joshua 11, 21 through 22. So it says this, "And Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah, from the hill country of Israel. Joshua devoted them to the destruction with their cities." This is what God told him to do, to kill these cities, kill these people in these cities. "There was none of the Anakim left in the land of the people of Israel. Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did some remain." And I show you on the map, those are three cities today, or three areas of that of Gaza. Those were supposed to be overcome by Joshua. Joshua did not fulfill the Lord's command. Whether you want to call that coincidence or not, I'll leave that up to you. But today, those three key areas happen to be a offspring of violence. Something else that I found interesting, when David learned of the death of King Saul, and it happened in Gaza with the Philistines, and as well as killing Jonathan, King David's best friend, if you will. And this is what he said: "Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph." Why is that important? Because if you look today, when the people would have these, what they would perceive as victories over the Israelis today, and some incredibly heinous acts, I'm not going to get into the details of the war, but even prior to that, children being killed, elderly being killed, beheaded, burned, whatever. They would celebrate, the children would celebrate, and they would hand out candy. And they would look at it as a joyous celebration. And you go back to the time here in 1 Samuel, and that's exactly not handing out candy, I don't know, but they were celebrating this cause. Other interesting fact to me is, the Philistines, as we know, that's where Goliath came from, his four brothers, and these are the giants. And this is not only the giants, this is really the area, and much of that, has to do and ties back to the Nephilim. But what I want to get at is, if you look at that coastline, I'm going to show you something interesting here. I'm going to read from a book. It's called, let's see if I get it, Etched in Stone. And this has to do with archaeological evidence. This dates back to 1120 to 1011 BC for the Philistines. 1 Samuel 13 says this: "The Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth Aven." So this is what they came to find. So I'm saying that about 1 Samuel because of the Philistines being the arch enemy of the Israelites. "The Philistines were Israel's most notorious enemies. They appeared on the scene circa 1200 BC. They were known as Sea People. Their territory was located along the west bank of the country between Gezer and Gaza near the Mediterranean Sea. Philistines were descended from Noah's son Ham through his son Mizraim. As cousins to the Babylonians, the Philistines worshipped the gods Dagon and Ashtaroth and had no regard for the Lord. Their most infamous Philistine was the mighty military giant Goliath, the one who fought young David and lost. Though a number of military exploits and victories, the Israelites were able to expand their territory, although the Philistines always seemed to be a thorn in Israel's side. It was, in fact, the Philistines who killed the first king of Israel, King Saul and his sons," and I kind of covered that earlier. This was another from a correspondent of PBS's Religion and Ethics Newsweekly, said this: "Modern archaeology has uncovered a wealth of information regarding the Philistine Sea People, thoroughly consistent with their portrayal in the Bible. For example, sources including numerous Egyptian inscriptions indicate the Philistines most likely originated in the Aegean area, probably on the island of Crete. That fits with the biblical passage of Jeremiah 47:4 and Deuteronomy 2:3, linking them with Kaphtor, which we know today as Crete, a location most scholars identify as Crete. Additionally, the Bible depicts the Philistines as expert metallurgists, and archaeologists have found evidence to back this up. So I'm saying all this because the Philistines, from this map perspective, they came from the Mediterranean. They were called the Sea People. And this is the origins of this name is really what I want to get at. So I'm going to show you again on video here that the Philistines invaded Israel 1177, and I show you the map and the history of these people. So they came from that Aegean Sea area, you know, through the Mediterranean, through Crete. Jeremiah 47:4, what I was just alluding to. Because of the day that comes to spoil all the Philistines, to cut them off from Tyrus and Zidon, every helper that remains. For the Lord will spoil the Philistines, the remnant of the country of Kaphtor, which is modern-day Crete. So that's where the origin of these people came from. And some people would say that this is who the current modern-day Palestinians are, which is why I'm bringing this up. So just to show you a little bit of history from the Table of Nations, again, because, you know, it alludes to this, and I show you in the red and the blue where this came from, and Ham, which is where you will find most, if not all, of the Nephilim tribes. They were coming in from that area on the left and you know, from that greater crescent area of Iraq and into the area through Israel and the Mediterranean coastline to Arabia and so forth. So, and Ham also in terms of the African coast as well. So that's where the origins of these people came from. That's why I wanted to highlight that. And the reason behind it is important because, well, I'll show you in a second. So you've got the Philistines. So some will claim that's their ancestors. That's where we know the name came from because, again, I go back to the emperor in Rome just because he wanted to annoy the Hebrews at the time. That's where you get that name from. Others would say, and Yasser Arafat would have said, that they are ancestors of the Canaanites, and this is the origins of the Palestinian people. Both of those cannot be true. The Canaanites were completely obliterated in the 13th century BC by the Israelites. Whatever remained was absorbed into the Hebrew society. The Philistines, which means invaders, they say that that's, some Palestinians would say that's part of their origin. That can't be true as well because by the 7th century BC, the Philistines were assimilated by the Syrians and later conquered by the Babylonians. Remember, if you go back to the very beginning, we're talking about ancient Israel and the Babylonians. So the Babylonians conquered that area. And so interestingly enough, if you take the DNA of the people of that area today, ones who would refer to themselves as Palestinians, and I mean no disrespect at all. So if you're listening to this and you're Palestinian background, I am not trying to disrespect at all. I'm just trying to get at the heart of truth. The DNA is Arab. It's Saudis, Iraqis, Syrians, Jordanians. They're true Arabs. That's their backing. And then interestingly, Genesis 16 says this about Ishmael. The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant. You will give birth to a son." This is speaking to Hagar. "You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be like a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all of his brothers." So I would say that's pretty accurate to what you see today. They are not content, if you will. They fight with one another. I think that's pretty obvious. And then you can do the division between the Sunnis and the Shias as far as Islam is concerned. So your DNA for these people is Arab, and I'm prefacing that because of what I'm about to bring up. So let's see. Let me cut to this. Prime Minister Golda Meir, who was in the late 60s, early 70s, I'm going to read you quotes concerning the backing of this information. From Golda Meir, she caught a lot of heat for it, but also I'm going to quote you four other Arab sources, highly regarded, that substantiate this. So again, I'll point to the video and I'm going to read you the quotes from these different people. Golda Meir said this: "There is no such thing as the Palestinian people. It's not as if we came and threw them out and took their country. They didn't exist." Then if you go to 1937, Anwi Abdul Hadi, who was the commission testimony, I'm sorry. He said this: "This is an Arab. There is no such country as Palestine. Palestine is a term the Zionists invented." Again, that goes back to the Romans. "There is no Palestine in the Bible. Palestine is alien to us. A Saudi representative to the United Nations in 1956. It is common knowledge that Palestine is nothing but southern Syria." A Lebanese intellectual, if you will, a Harvard educated: "There is no such thing as Palestine in history. Absolutely not." This was Dr. Philip Heaty of the Anglo-American Committee testimony in 1946. And later, I'm going to say this was probably in the 70s, Hafez al-Assad. So Assad, who is the president of Syria today, this is his father. He died in the 90s. He confronted Yasser Arafat, who was trying to push this whole thing about the Palestinians. And he said this publicly to Arafat. He said, "Never forget this one point. There is no such thing as a Palestinian people. There is no Palestinian entity. Palestine is an integral part of Syria." So he was looking at it as, you know, again, southern Syria. And I go back to these maps. This is, again, not any disregard or I'm not saying that these people, everybody should be treated with the utmost dignity, love, respect, care. But what is being facilitated in terms of Palestine is just not accurate. And what concerns me, and I'll show you, you know, on video where I see, you know, these, here I am in America, these Harvard educated and some of the highly regarded media outlets. They're calling for Palestinian freedom, free the oppressors, boycott Israel, support the Palestinian resistance, protest for Palestine, you know, and to the point where Jewish people are being threatened and they feel, put yourself in the shoes, nobody should be oppressed, but put yourself in the shoes of Jews today. When they see this, that they're, you know, that they're the atrocities of war, where these people targeted them specifically because they are Jewish, nothing else, beheading babies, burning babies, raping women, killing children in front of their parents and parents in front of their children. There's actually, I think, one, if not more, Holocaust survivors were actually kidnapped into Gaza. You can't believe it, but that is the degree of hatred, which is why I say anti-Semitism is Satanism, and I will stand by that. I'm going to wind this down, but I'm going to read some things and show you some things that I think are critically important, and it demonstrates what I believe is the obviousness of what we see today. So Mark Twain in 1967. He took a voyage aboard a steamship called Quaker City, bringing him from San Francisco to Europe to the Middle East. His objective was he wanted to go to Israel. He wanted to see Jerusalem. And he wasn't even a believer, although his heritage had that. He kept a notebook through the journey, observing this: "The pen and the pad is my vision." His writings were eventually compiled into a book called The Innocents Abroad, which became and still is to this day his number one best-selling book. Now, I'm going to say this, and it may sound crazy to some people. I believe Mark Twain is who is referenced in Deuteronomy 29:22 through 23. And it says this, "And the generation to come, your children, that shall rise up after you, and the foreigner," or also translated as the stranger, Nakri in Hebrew, "that shall come forth from a land, and he shall bear witness when they see the plagues of this land, the sickness wherein the Lord hath made it sick, and that the whole land therefore is brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown, not beareth, nor does any grass grow, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Adam and Zebulun, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and his wrath." So he's saying the land is cursed, but there will come forth a stranger that will testify to this before he calls, or before it's declared in your name. So you, the Jewish people would be starting to come back. And I say all this, and I show you, I believe I showed you the picture of this. You know, this is that upper, that picture on the upper right, and I'll show you more in a minute. This was a desolate, malaria-infested wasteland. And I'm going to read some things here, and I apologize for the small print, but I wanted to get this in here. I'm going to read what the Bible describes as the curse and what is on this land, and what, and where you see the initials MT stands for Mark Twain, what he wrote. And what he wrote is incredibly similar to what was written thousands of years earlier in the Word of God. It says, "The whole land thereof is brimstone and salt." Mark Twain wrote, "All desolate and unpeopled, miles of desolate country, far-reaching desolation, the waste of limitless desolation." The Bible calls the land a burning waste. The New Living Translation says, "You have become a scorching desert." Twain writes, "It is a scorching, arid, repulsive solitude. Such roasting heat, such oppressive solitude, such dismal desolation cannot surely exist elsewhere on earth. Nowhere on all the waste around was there a foot of shade. We were scorching to death." The Bible, "All of its land is unsown." Twain, "One may ride 10 miles hereabouts and not see human beings. These unpeopled deserts, these rusty mounds of barrenness that never, never, never do shake the glare from the harsh outlines. There is no solitary village throughout its whole extent, not for 30 miles in either direction." The Bible, "Nor does it bear any life." Twain, "The valleys are unsightly deserts fringed with a feeble vegetation, a desert paved with loose stones, void of vegetation, glaring in its fierce sun, this blistering, naked, treeless land. No sprig of grass is visible." The Bible, "The anger of the Lord burned against this land to bring upon it every curse that is written in this book." Twain, "Palestine sits in a sackcloth and ashes. Over it broods the spell of a curse. Palestine is desolate and unlovely, and why should it be otherwise? Can the curse of deity beautify a land?" And for you on video, I show you pictures of around this time of what Twain took, just rocks and malaria-infested wastelands. And, you know, you again, you wouldn't see people for 10, 20, 30 miles in a clip. They're basically, nomads and you know, some occasional sheep herders. You had, you know, certainly the architectural structures of the land, but this is what this was. This was a barren, desolate land that people were not interested in. And, you know, we come to find out that many people, the people who owned this land were Arabs who lived in other areas. They lived in Syria. They lived in Iraq. They lived in what was today be modern day Jordan. Some of them were affluent. They owned this land. So what began to happen was in the mid to late 19th century, Jews began to come back to the land. And as God said, he said, "I am calling them back." This was a miracle. And they what they did was they bought the land, and they paid a premium price for this. So the people who owned the land, they didn't even want the mountainous regions, they kept to themselves for the most part. And they sold the land. And if you go from into the 19th to the 20th century, I believe the richest, most fertile land was somewhere in the Iowa farms, some of the Midwest farms. The land would go for up to $110 an acre. The Jews would be paying for this land that I described and showed you on video up to $1,000 an acre. but they felt like they were called. They're doing it. So, you know, as they buy this land, and I'm going to show you, there was a quote from David Ben-Gurion, who you know, led the charge and signed the initial order of the installment of Israel. But he was the labor leader at the time in 1920, and he said this: under no circumstance must we touch land belonging to fellaheen, which are Arab workers, or worked by them. Only if a fella leaves his place of settlement should we offer to buy his land and do so at an appropriate price. So the Jews at that time were buying the land, and they were paying what he deemed appropriate, but and we know a lot of this was far above and beyond. And what has it become today? So, you know, I'm showing you some images now on video of just as the Bible prophesied that this land that was desolate and wasted would become a flowers blooming in the desert. It's the largest exporter of flowers today. I've been to Israel. It's just a miracle. You see the vastness and the richness of the farmland wherever you go. So it's a rich, prosperous, and fertile country that has been farmed by the Jews, by the Israelis. And is there a degree of jealousy? Probably. But nonetheless, it is the miracle in the desert. And I wanted to explore and unpack these truths, because ultimately I'm going to read what I believe is behind all of this, which is Satan. In Revelation 12:9, I show you, and it says, "The great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who was called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him." He is deceiving the entire world right now. You have so many people who, you know, who are clinging to this Palestinian it's not a matter of me taking delight. Again, I sympathize, and my heart goes for all of the Arabs, and you know, this tiny sliver of land that I'll show you on a map as it compares is owned by Israel. And if you are an Arab and you're willing to work with the Israelis, you can work in that land, and you can, you know, succeed in that land, and many have. So you show that little piece, and I'm going to get to something, as I promise I am closing this. But I want to show you what God promised Israel, because it's not even remotely close to what it is today, and it never has been. So if you go back to Genesis 15, 18 through 21, I'm going to bring this to video. It says, "On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, and he said, 'To your descendants, I give this land from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadamites, Hittites, Perizzites, Raphaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites.'" So I show you that. And in the map, it shows you all of the land that encompasses that. That takes care of all of modern-day Israel, all of Jordan, Lebanon, most of Syria, parts of Iraq, parts of Saudi Arabia, parts of Egypt, parts of Kuwait, and parts of Turkey. They have never come even remotely close to what the Lord promised them. I personally believe that when Jesus returns in the millennium, this is the land that will be designated for them. I don't have anything to back that up other than a hunch. And, you know, that's my hunch. But I want to show you something on a global scale. I'm showing you this map. There are 22 Arab states. There are 52 Muslim states. There is one Jewish state. And I show you, and this gives you the breakdown. The light green is Sunni, and the darker green is Shia. But it shows you all of the Arab and the Muslim nations all around the world. And I show you that little tiny red arrow in there. That's Israel. That's the one little Jewish nation. And they want to throw them into the sea. They want to disperse them. They want to say they have no legal bounds to it. But yet, if you go back to history, they are the originators. They are from that land. And you can back, and there's much more information, and you can go back to a lot in Egypt that would back that up. But this bit about them being colonialists, and unfortunately, our 44th not 44, would say things like this. They are, in my opinion, and I think it's clear, they are the indigenous people. If you look at the map and you look at history and everything that they've gone through and everything that's been oppressed, you can tie this, you can make a case if people want to feel that way about America and how we treated the American Indian. I say it's far, far worse than what we have done to the Jewish people, you know, globally as a whole. So, you know, just take a look at that map and see that little red arrow, and that's it. And I'll close with this. There's a famous quote. It's a poetic quip from a British journalist, William Norman Ewer. And he says this: "How odd of God to choose the Jews." Why did God choose the Jews? And I, you know, it's a question that people will ask. And I say because it is his sovereign purpose to do so. You know, this is the Lord's plan. This is the nation. This is the only nation that God created. He created it, which, if you are not a believer, that in of itself, that the fact that it's being fought for, this one area of the world that God said would be the case, that he would make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for the entire world, and sure enough, that's exactly what was prophesied. That alone should tell you that Jesus Christ is alive and well, and he's coming back, and he's coming soon. There are two pivotal prophecies, I would say, concerning Jesus, concerning Israel and Jesus, that have not been fulfilled. Israel does not yet occupy all of the land that God promised, and I showed you that. And his people have not yet turned to Christ. You know, Israel, and I don't mean to paint Israel as any, Israel and their government and their people have plenty of problems, plenty of issues, plenty of things that I don't agree with. They are very, very secular. And this is what was prophesied. They have not turned their hearts. They have been reborn, brought back to the land, but they have not become spiritually alive. They have not recognized Yeshua as their Messiah. If you read Isaiah 53 to them, most of them will begin to cry because they'll recognize that it is the description of what they did to Jesus. The numerous prophecies concerning Israel's return to the homeland were fulfilled in 1948. So God called them back and told them they would be gone for 70 years, specifically to Babylon. They came back after 70 years. All of those prophecies concerning the return, Jerusalem, the rebuilding of the temple, all of that exactly as was prophesied. And then they would be dispersed again throughout the world, and they would be brought back again. So everything has happened, and then the nation is born in a day, exactly as what the Bible described. All of this biblically is true, as well as all the factual and historical evidence, but the fact that we know these books were written thousands of years ago and we're seeing this fulfilled in our lifetime, and the signs are pointing to the return of Jesus, because when you see these signs and when you, he says, look up, your redemption draws near. So it's that much closer. So this gives us full assurance that the restoration is on the horizon. Prophecies of Israel is coming. The Messiah is coming. And I'm going to close with this, what was written by Milton Lindbergh. Without the existence of the nation of Israel, we would not be able to say with certainty we are in the last days. That single event, more than any other, is the most prominent sign that we are living in the final moments before the coming of Jesus. I could not agree more. So there you have it. I hope this information was helpful, that you were able to get something from it. I just want to thank you again, as always, for your time. If you have any questions, comments, please, you know, hit us up online. Email russickoutlook@gmail.com. Make comments on Rumble, on YouTube. Please subscribe to those channels. And as well as we are on social media with Instagram and I think it's called X now instead of Twitter. That's it. So now, actually, let me close with this before I cut. If you are a believer, please pray. Please pray not only for the people of Israel, be praying for the people in Gaza. Be praying for the men, the women, the children, the innocent. You know, Jesus loves them all. Jesus came for them all. Jesus came for Hamas. Jesus came for those terrorists in the tunnels and in Gaza. Jesus loves you. There's no question about it. So, you know, this is not a matter of choosing sides. This is a matter of right and wrong, good and evil. And if you have hatred in your heart towards one people or another, That's wrong. And I would suggest you just confess those sins and give it to Jesus, and he will cleanse you and he will restore you and he will make you right before he returns again, which is ultimately what you have to. So I will then cut back to video and say thank you very much. And again, just questions or comments, russickoutlook@gmail.com. My name is Mark. You've been listening to the Russick Outlook. And remember, as always, just my opinion.